This is Eleanor Swent continuing an interview with Frank Jocklick in Salt Lake City on February 22nd, 1994. All right.
Are we live?
Yes,
yeah.
We're on.
The P&G government was a little skeptical about our reporting the results of our exploration program periodically. You're rightly, you mentioned Octeti. This was a porphyry copper gold project pretty close to the border between Papua New Guinea and West Irian. The ore body was discovered by Kennicott, and all this happened was during my AMAX years. Mm-hmm. But essentially, Kennicott proved up the ore body, and then found it impossible to negotiate a satisfactory agreement with the P&G government. When I say satisfactory, I mean an agreement that would have given Kennicott a decent return on its projected investment. Kennicott therefore did not proceed with the development of Octeti. The development went ahead subsequently by consortium, which included BHP and I think Preussag, German company, and Amoco, and had a checkered history, which I don't want to go in now. But in essence, walking away from Octeti gave Kennicott an image with the P&G government, which they referred to once or twice in our negotiations concerning Lihir. In other words, they wondered whether we were dragging our feet on a supposed bonanza, when in actuality we were working furiously both on the exploration and the engineering problems associated with the project, and spending very large amounts of money doing it.
There was also an extra pressure to be environmentally careful, wasn't there, because of Octeti?
No, I don't think so. As I said before, we approached it in a very responsible way from word go, because we recognized if it didn't do that, it would backfire in the long term. But that wasn't really related by Octeti experience, because we weren't involved in the development of Octeti, and what happened there afterwards really didn't spill over to the Lihir project particularly. When I mentioned the P&G government, let me just say this. The government is headquartered in Port Moresby. 700 languages are spoken in PNG, in Papua New Guinea. Throughout those cultures, land ownership is the measure of a man or a woman's worth, which is both good and bad. The good part is that they understand the concept of ownership as opposed to a communal or nomadic kind of a culture. Mm-hmm. And what we call free enterprise is something that they have no difficulty with in grasping.
Mm-hmm.
That's the good part. The not so good part is that this land ownership makes it difficult to obtain land tenure, to develop the mine and put all your processing facilities, the infrastructure, and so forth, and require negotiation, which in a culture that hasn't changed much in many hundreds of years is not necessarily done overnight. And the worst thing one can do is to mention time limits or to put pressure on the negotiating party to observe such time limits, because then they get suspicious and wonder whether they're not going to get the short end of the stick out of such negotiations.
Mm-hmm.
The government in Port Moresby, headed by statesmen such as Sir Michael Somare, who was the first Prime Minister of the Independent Nation, and Sir Julius Chan, who I think is now Deputy Prime Minister. These are extremely intelligent, educated people whom it would be fatal to underestimate in any way. In my many visits, perhaps one a year since 1983, to the project and negotiations with the Port Moresby government towards a, what they call a special mining lease, which spells out the conditions for development. I always found reasonable attitudes, provided one took the time and the trouble to explain in as much detail as was wanted or warranted what one's point of view was. There was help, of course, from a lot of Australian expatriates still in the administration in Port Moresby, but even during the 10 years that of my experience there, the number of really capable expatriate officials dwindled rapidly.
They were leaving?
Yeah, because you know, the aim is and should be to staff responsible positions,
mm-hmm,
with nationals. So there's no such thing as building a career there,
no,
for an expatriate, nor should there be. The changes of ownership of Kennecott also had to be dealt with. By the late 1980s, we had pretty close to $100 million spent on the exploration and engineering of Lihir. Our stride was broken temporarily in 1988 when the gold show, or the, not just the gold show, the idea of a floating a gold company was pursued, and I'll talk about that separately. By the end of a decade, the prospect had been drilled out and shown to contain between 30 and 40 million ounces of gold. And the question became how much of this could be profitably extracted. We had some differences of opinion. We thought the Zeds people in London on that score. Some of us leant towards making it a large project with a high daily mining and throughput rate, and economizing as much as possible, or as much as would be prudent on capital expenditures. In this regard, we enlisted the help of consultants who had experience at Misima and at Porgera. The RTZ people opted for a lower throughput rate and selectively mining higher grade material, meanwhile stockpiling the lower grade material for future processing.
How did you feel about this?
I've always felt, you know, from my experience at Mount Newman and other places, that you should develop an ore deposit at its natural rate of production. And every ore body, I think, has that.
But you also kind of decide what that is, don't you?
Yeah, it becomes a matter for decision, but the numbers speak for themselves. And what is essential is to be extremely careful about the basic assumptions that are made in designing a project. biggest mistakes that I've seen made is when that phase of a project is hurried, the assumptions are assembled with haste, and an engineering contractor is set to work and starts generating drawings in order to fill several floors
mm-hmm.
of an office building and with as many people as are available, and produce a conceptual design and then a detailed design which does not produce the best economics of the project. Time after time I've seen that happen. But if you take the time to formulate the tough questions and answer them before engineers get to work in earnest,
what are these?
You've got a chance of coming up with a good project.
What are these questions?
Oh, well.
How long do you want the project to last?
No. That drops out right at the end. Yeah.
How much
ore? First of all, the first thing is define your ore reserves.
Okay.
Second thing is to get the metallurgy straight.
Mm-hmm.
The third thing is to look at your infrastructure requirements.
Mm-hmm.
Then preliminary mine plan. Conceptual project design.
Now these are very good.
And then an estimate of the initial costs, which allows for the unknowns existing at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And rarely happens.
That's where your judgment comes in.
And then an honest-to-goodness look at operating costs with a contingency built in. And if those are not gone into in all deliberation, all honesty, you're going to finish up with something that ain't going to work. In this particular case that they're here, the way it seems to be going now, it's difficult to say. I'm convinced this will make an excellent project in due course. But at the moment, the ownership is still up in the air because RTZ made several attempts to bring others into the project. The extent of government ownership, I don't think, has been nailed down yet. And detailed plans for development have been submitted to the government, on the basis of which hopefully the special mining lease will be granted, and then the project can go ahead.
It's still really not off the ground though at all.
Well, I just must refer to the journals. Mm. There's mm. something about Lee here in the journal just about every day.
Mm-hmm.
And
you did a huge feasibility study.
We did several feasibility studies over the years, but it was always a matter of recognizing new difficulties and recognizing mm-hmm. new opportunities that needed mm-hmm. to be evaluated and dealt with.
It's a long time now.
But not unusual for large projects in remote locations. Not unusually 10 years is, mm-hmm. if anything, on the short side from discovery.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a virgin discovery. So, my last visit to Lee here was in September of 92, and that was the first time that I'd taken Pam to see the project. Mm-hmm. We had a very good series of meetings. Well, I say we, not Pam, but I mean mm-hmm. the people who were with me, with the government officials there, with Pius Wingti, P-I-A-I-S, was Prime Minister, and Julius Chan was Deputy Prime Minister at that time, and you know, the stage seemed to be set for the project to proceed. That's probably all I should say about it at this time.
So the decision of the size of the throughput is still...
No, I think that's pretty much nailed down.
Mm-hmm.
Time will tell whether it's the optimum rate. Perhaps it's the right thing to start small and aim to build up with time.
I must be mistaken. I thought that there had been, maybe not at Lihir, but in parts of Papua New Guinea, real dangers of personnel being murdered by the...
Oh yeah, there's Bougainville.
Okay.
That's Bougainville.
But not
Bougainville Island.
Uh-huh.
And, well, hang on. There's no need to go into Bougainville here. We all know how it was shut down about 5 or 6 years ago, and what is the name of the rebel leader there? And peace still hasn't returned to Bougainville. Maybe one day it will, and the great mine there will resume operation. But you're right, there have been difficulties at Mount Kari. There was a problem there, and I think at Porgera at one stage too, a couple of years ago, there was some violence.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what can I say? It's a beautiful country. It's a wild country, with malaria is still very rampant there, and the people, the nationals, lead a hard life, and some of them are more warlike than others.
But nobody at Lahir has been attacked to date.
Mm-hmm. There's 4,000 people on Lahir Island,
mm-hmm.
and relations with them have been good. Now it's necessary to negotiate with them an agreement for the use of the land.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have to be relocated, and the agreement for that, I think, has been pretty well concluded. When Porgera went ahead, the government made some project participation available to the Engans, E-N-G-A-N-S, who are the people who inhabit that province. And the Porgera agreement, I believe, has been the subject of renegotiation. And similarly, a final agreement will have to be worked out regarding Lahir, taking into account the position both of the national government in Port Moresby, the provincial government, which is headquartered in Kavieng, K-A-V-I-E-N-G. On New Island, Lahir comes into that province, and the position of the Lahir people themselves. Mm-hmm. In the end, they're the ones that the project will impact, and they're the ones that have to feel comfortable with being transported from the South Sea Island idyllic existence into the 20th and 21st centuries. With a major integrated mine development and the best available technology in the world.
Oh. Real challenge.
Yeah. Yeah, I spent a good part of my last 12 years with Kennecott on that. It nearly died several times.
Mm-hmm.
The project nearly died several times, but we resuscitated it in the conviction that this is going to make a great natural resource project that will benefit the people who live there, the people of Papua New Guinea, and the shareholders of the owners.
Whoever they may be.
Well,
right.
Okay. Shall we now move on to, as I heralded previously, a couple of projects which we inherited from BP.
I just did want to kind of mention BP was only in the picture for 2 years, actually.
Well, they were in the picture. See, they were the majority owners of Standard Oil.
So they were already
all along
in there.
Yeah. Oh, sure. It's just that their presence came to be brought to bear directly rather than through Standard Oil.
But there must have been reverberations of all these changes that were going.
Oh. The care and feeding of successive owners. Lee was a pretty time-consuming and sometimes
discouraging.
No, sometimes. Oh, sometimes stressful. You know,
sure.
If people were involved who just had their own agenda.
Had to keep re-educating them.
Yeah. Anyway.
Mm-hmm.
The two projects we inherited when we became part of BP, when BP took over the majority holding of, when they took over the part of Standard Oil they didn't own already, and that happened in
89, I think. No, 87.
That happened in 87. You're absolutely
89
right.
89 was RTCF. 87 was BP.
89. When BP acquired the remainder of Standard Oil in 1987, Kennecott became BP Minerals America. We weren't too fond of that name and didn't think it was going to last. That sounds great now with the benefit of hindsight. It wasn't really that way. But BP Minerals America seemed to be too large of a mouthful to ever really work. It was analogous to BP abolishing the Standard Oil name. Now that really I found very strange, because this was the Standard Oil Company. What a proud name.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to be able to dispense with a brand name with such a great image was throwing a lot of money away for BP to do. As you know, when RTZ bought BP's minerals business, the first thing they did was restore the Kennecott name because they recognized the value of such a well-recognized name around the world, mm-hmm. in particularly mineral exploration and development. Yeah. Well, this BP Minerals America came to include two properties that had resulted from BP's North American exploration and acquisition activities. The one was Ridgeway,
excuse me, and I should know this, but where was BP's headquarters then?
Was in their exploration headquarters, uh-huh. in Denver, and that was dissolved, and the people came here. We absorbed, Kennecott absorbed.
So they moved
that.
Here then.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So their minerals operation had all been out of
Denver. Yeah. It took us an evening of entertaining the bee people up at La Cai and explaining the facts of life to them for that decision to be reached.
Okay. Entertaining them where?
At La Cai. You don't know La Cai, the restaurant? Quail Run? It's a very, very good and picturesque. Yeah, here in Salt Lake.
Okay, yes.
Very
all
good
right.
restaurant here okay. in Salt Lake. La Cai, LACAILLE.
Okay. Now, where is BP's headquarters? In England?
Yeah.
London?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Okay. So to move from there, RTZ was just across the street, as it were.
Pretty much, yeah. Mm-hmm. Same town, yeah.
Not such a wrench as... Yeah.
No, it is kind of a natural mm-hmm. to happen.
Okay, so Ridgeway.
Ridgeway was about 15 miles north of Columbia in South Carolina. It's a gold deposit in the Carolina Slate Belt, as it's known. Geologically, gold had been discovered. Incidentally, do you know that North Carolina, South Carolina, all through the 19th century, was the premier gold-producing region in the United States before the California Gold Rush. Mm. Before
from
the days,
colonial days.
Before the days of 1847,
mm-hmm.
South Carolina was it.
Mm-hmm. We don't realize that now.
Right. Gold had been discovered at Ridgeway by a local prospector called John Chapman, and I think the initial drilling was done by the State Geological Survey, and finally BP acquired it. BP had farmed out a 48% interest to a company called Galactic, which has since then acquired some notoriety.
Galactic Resources?
Yeah, in connection with Summitville, Colorado,
uh-huh.
and whatever. While I'm on the subject of ownership, we bought out, as Kennecott bought out their 48% interest 3 or 4 years ago, and it's now 100% Kennecott owned. But they drilled out a large low-grade resource there in two deposits, aggregating about 56 million tons, running 0.03 ounces of gold. In many respects, Ridgeway is very similar in my mind to Misima in Papua New Guinea. Very similar kind of deposit and operation. When we, that is Kennecott, then acquired Ridgeway, the development had run into severe opposition from an environmental lobby in South Carolina, and this held up development for a year or two, but development did proceed in 1988.
Supposed to be an open pit.
Yeah, it's an open pit, and the ore is crushed and ground, and agitated in Pachucas, I was going to say, in reactor tanks, and the gold is recovered by Merrill Crowe. Is it a Merrill Crowe event? I think it is. Because of the silver content.
Mm-hmm. So it's not it's a leaching.
Yeah, but it's leached in...
not a heap leach operation.
It's not heap leach, right. No, it's not miracle. It's carbon in leach technology. So it is carbon recovery, sorry. Forgot about that. It has about a 12-year life, and has been profitable since operations began. Yeah.
Price of gold has dropped considerably during that time, hasn't it?
Not that much, no. I'll talk more about that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when you say drop, it was from 420 to about 380 mm-hmm. now.
But it it's came in after the high gold prices.
Yeah. I remember the opening was in August of 89,
mm-hmm.
and Lieutenant Governor Nick Theodore was there. And he was a very popular politician, and he a pretty man of average height, but very strongly built. And we had shown him, I think, the pouring of the first gold bar, or
mm-hmm.
maybe not the first, but anyway, witnessed this. So we started joking about how heavy it was. And I said, Governor, you can pick it up with one hand, it's yours. So he rolled up his sleeve, and what wasn't apparent was that he had biceps about 8 or 10 inches strong. So I had an anxious moment there while he grabbed hold of this thing and tried to lift it.
You thought he might.
What is it? It's about 400 ounces, isn't it?
I think so,
yeah.
Heavy.
He didn't get it off the ground.
Thank heaven.
It was a close call. So that's the first of these BP projects that we brought on stream, or that we built and brought on stream. The other one was Greens Creek, Alaska. The development of Greens Creek was in terrible shape when we took over. I forget how much site work had taken place, but this was a case of rushing or trying to rush into production without having spent much time on the basic assumptions. The milling rate of 1,000 tons a day was pulled out of thin air. The mine plan did not take into account the configuration of the ore body, so that had we proceeded with the design we inherited, we would have encountered, or with the plan we inherited, we would have encountered excessive dilution. No backup for cost estimates, either capital or operating cost estimates available. There was no cost accounting system. There was no tracking of expenditures versus the budget. There was no trending to update the estimate for project completion. I got an inkling of what was happening when I read the when I read the AFE document.
What's that?
Authorization for expenditure. The feasibility study, if you like. Mm-hmm. And it went into great detail about who's going to be running the project and how they were going to be living and so on, but there wasn't any mention of who's going to build the project. There was only a very brief references that an EPC manager would be hired, that's engineering, procurement, and construction manager would be hired to build the project. Just like a hired gun, more or less. Well,
but the board had, this was the board's baby. I mean, it came to you already approved.
Yes, it did.
They had approved.
Well, we sent Raman Rao and Al Nuttall up there to look at the project, and they just came back aghast at what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
They had a estimate of, I think, $70 million for project completion, and it was clear that it couldn't be done less for about $115 million,
mm-hmm.
if that. So the first thing we did was that we put in a top-notch team. Consisting of Al Nuttall to manage the engineering, procurement, and construction, Ward Wimborne to act as to be the general manager, and Tracy Stevenson to install controls.
This was in
October of 88.
So this was already, it was outside this Alaska National Lands problem.
Well, this was, Greens Creek is in a non-wilderness portion of the Admiralty Island National Monument.
Hmm.
And it's, the land is administered by the Forest Service.
Mm.
And so the first thing we did was to establish relations with them. Came up with credible capital and operating cost estimates, modified the design considerably, and we won the confidence of the Forest Service that we were going to do this in an environmentally sound way. Because, you know, Juneau is just across the water from there, and
mm-hmm.
That's a government town, and they were watching very closely what was going on, as they should have been. And in that regard, let me say that the whole exercise then of building the project, which we did, was done in a way that the Forest Service afterwards held it up as an example of how to develop a complex mining operation in a tremendously sensitive environment.
Mm-hmm.
In a tremendously sensitive environment. As you know, it's an underground mine. It's a exhalative seafloor massive sulfide deposit. I have to throw in these little bits because that's what
mm-hmm.
you know, defines the geology a little bit. This is a 1,000-ton-a-day operation. When it was completed, the opening took place in September of 89. And the annual production is 6 million ounces of silver projected. But it's a mixed metal ore body and produces gold, lead, zinc, and copper as well. So we completed the project within the budget and the schedule that we then established. We continued exploration drilling, and in, I believe it was in 91, we found a very substantial addition to the ore reserves. I don't exactly recall the numbers anymore, but the ore reserves, when the mine was opened, was 3.5 million tons running supposedly 23 ounces per ton of silver, 0.18 of an ounce per ton of gold, 3.9, at least 4% lead and 10% zinc. But that was, see, whereas we redesigned the project, we couldn't revise the ore reserve estimates. No. There wasn't time to do any additional drilling. Well, these grades turned out to have been way over optimistic. And from day one of operation, there was great difficulty in meeting the projected grades at 1,000 tons a day. Mm. That's where this discovery then, I think it was in 1991 when we discovered this major addition to ore reserves, wasn't in the thin lenses that the ore reserve drilled to that date occurred in. It was a equidimensional sort of blowout of mineralization, which had been no indication of its existence previously, and increased the ore reserves from 3 million tons to more like 13 million tons. Well, with the decline of base and precious metal prices that occurred after the opening, Greens Creek began to lose money. And early in 93, we decided that it was best to shut the operation down and proceed with planning an expanded operation that would utilize the additional ore discovered. And this is what's been going on at Greens Creek.
That you had to close it down while you do this.
Well, we closed, it wasn't because we wanted to do this, it was losing money. We didn't want to incur further operating losses and to run the risk of mining relatively high-grade material and still losing money.
Mm-hmm.
We felt it would be much more sense to preserve that material for a new mine plan, expanded concentrator with better project economics.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the planning that has been going on.
So when the price goes up, you can reactivate it?
Well, not necessarily just a function of price. I'm saying that the expansion itself may be enough to make a viable operation out of it, hopefully.
And are they proceeding with that now?
To the best of my knowledge, yes.
I see. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now,
then there was
the time has come now to talk about the much heralded BP Gold, otherwise referred to as the Gold Show.
Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you a little bit about that.
Let me just check. Okay.
After the acquisition of Kennecott by Standard Oil, inevitably there tended to be talk about making a public company out of all or part of Kennecott at some time in the future. I remember a meeting in May of 86 when my associates at that time, when some of my associates at that time, Don DeBrier, Jack Bernheisel, Byron Grote, when we met with Frank Mosier and proposed to him making a public offering of Kennecott shares. This was spurred by the great interest in gold floats at that time and the tremendous multiples, that is, price earnings multiples that existed in the markets at that time. The idea would have been to demonstrate value to the market for the benefit of shareholders over and above the contribution by Kennecott's to simply Standard Oil's share price. The timing then would have been excellent, but Mr. Mosier didn't have a record of readily acceding to ideas generated by Kennecott personnel. The idea didn't die, however, and evoked some interest in BP, particularly after BP acquired the remainder of Standard Oil and thereby Kennecott. And what came to be suggested was a float of Kennecott's gold interests. Now, as you pointed out, because Kennecott had all along had major gold production out of Bingham Canyon, mm-hmm. Running at that time at the rate of maybe 3.5 million ounces a year. Perhaps the second biggest gold producer in the United States, or maybe the third after Homestake and Carlin. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. I just remember they always had to say they were the first primary gold producers or something. They always had to put this exception in for Kennecott because Kennecott was seen as a copper company, but they
That's
were
right.
out producing the gold companies.
Yeah. Maybe I haven't mentioned this, but the gold at Bingham Canyon accounts, depending on what prices you're talking about, mm-hmm. for maybe a quarter of the revenues.
Mm-hmm.
Well, prices high, maybe as much as a third.
Very significant.
Yeah. Well, the ore body runs 0.01 of an ounce.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes a little bit more, sometimes a little bit less. I mean, that's not far off heap leaching grade in Nevada.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, people often think of it as a, you know, an add-on to a copper ore body. Mm-hmm. The fact is, without the gold, this wouldn't be a copper ore body.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the gold is a necessary part of the economics of Bingham Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the idea that came to be evolved by the BP masterminds in London was to, well, it was a variation from what we had originally proposed, which is to do a float of Kennecott. But this was going to be just the gold. So along came this idea of bifurcation of Bingham Canyon, a term that no one had liked from the beginning. One fork being the copper, the other fork being the gold. Potentially an accounting and operational nightmare, but that's the thought. Split off the Bingham Canyon gold, marry it with the precious metals deposits under development, and that's